You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
It's a very great pleasure to introduce Paul Powsland. He is going to be talking about the rights of nature. So he is a barrister and has founded Lawyers for Nature. And he seeks to represent the natural world, also uphold the rights of environmental protesters, and use the environmental law to defend the natural world. What he's asked me to say is that he'd love questions at the end, so be thinking throughout the talk of questions that you'd like to ask. He's going to allow a good amount of time at the end for questions. So let's give him a warm welcome.
Thanks, everyone. And it's a real honour to be here. I often give talks about legal rights of nature, but today I'd really like to concentrate on one of the most powerful link-ups throughout history, which is between law and lawyers and the church and religion. And when those two forces are put together, they are incredibly powerful. So far, they've often been powerful in these lands in the wrong way. And I'm hoping that one of the things we might get out of today is to begin to forge a new alliance between religion and law that is powerful in the right way. Now, you're probably all familiar with the original sin of the way that the church has treated the natural world and the earth, which is Genesis 1:26-28. And God said, "Let us make man in our image and our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he him. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth and subdue it." Replenish the earth and subdue it. And have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Now, I don't want to just turn this into lawyer attacking religious folk. So I'm going to go straight into how that idea was then misapplied by a very famous English lawyer called Blackstone, who wrote the commentaries on the law of England, which effectively became the basis for the English common law, which of course was then spread around the world. So he then went on to say in his chapter on property, "In the beginning of the world, we are informed by holy writ, the all-bountiful creator gave to man dominion over all the earth and over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. This is the only true and solid foundation of man's dominion over external things. The earth, therefore, and all things therein are the general property of all mankind, exclusive of other beings, from the immediate gift of the Creator." I believe that those two passages combined together have created the most dangerous and destructive idea in human history. And that idea is that man, humans, are in dominion over nature, that nature is dead, it's a dead resource to be extracted and used for human ends, and that idea lies at the basis of all of the different crises that we see. So obviously there are some that are more serious than others, like the climate crisis, but the climate crisis is merely a symptom of that underlying broken relationship. And unless we fix that relationship and mend that original sin, if you like, that idea of nature as dead and us as separate from nature, none of those crises can be solved truly. And indeed, we could end up making them worse. For instance, if we try and solve climate as purely a carbon problem, we can end up destroying the earth, raising mountains to provide infinite amounts of renewable energy and all the other resources that go into making that. So fundamentally, we have to fix that broken relationship. And to me, rights of nature is a way of doing that. I want to say a little bit about how I got into rights of nature, because hopefully it might act as a way of saying that this idea, that this role is available to anyone, and you don't have to be a specialist to get into it. So I qualified as just an ordinary civil commercial barrister with no particular interest in environmental law. I've never actually studied environmental law, which makes me feel a bit guilty sometimes because people refer to me as an environmental lawyer. And that's actually not my one of my specialisms. But during my 20s, I very much fell in love with nature and began to see that the restoration of the natural world and the protection of the natural world was perhaps one of the highest ideals we should be aiming towards. And I started activism, planting trees, and then realized through the process of planting trees, how many people have been tree planting here? It's really difficult, isn't it? It's actually a really difficult process and loads of them die. And also it's kind of frustrating because you plant a tree and like, actually I've planted some willows, which do grow very fast, but like an oak is actually a little bit disappointing in some ways. Like it takes quite a long time to get going. And that planting of trees therefore taught me that we should be doing everything possible to retain all of the existing trees that we have, because in many respects, the trees that I plant are never going to be as magnificent as all the ones around us now within my lifetime. So I began to realize that I should be using my legal skills to try and protect the nature that we have, somewhat assuming that laws were in place to protect nature and that there was an adequate legal regime to protect nature. And then realizing that's bollocks, there actually isn't. And environmental law is fundamentally not there and doesn't actually protect nature. And the main process I realized that was through the Sheffield tree protesters and helping them. Does anyone know about the Sheffield trees? Sorry? Yeah, it's been a lot in the media because I would say it's one of the most successful environmental protests of the last decade in this country. Very, very briefly, for those that haven't heard of it, it's a very long dispute, but the basis of it was the Sheffield City Council signed a contract with a private contractor to repair their streets, and they realised that it's actually much more profitable to repair the streets by destroying all the trees, effectively. Local people rose up against that, using their bodies to stop that destruction and protect the trees. And I came in at a moment when people were being arrested for standing under trees, and I wrote a legal advice saying effectively that was unlawful. And the police stopped arresting people for standing under trees. Yay! But then the council came back a couple of months later with an injunction to put people in jail for standing under trees instead. Yeah, which wasn't... I didn't actually challenge this, but I went into court and lost repeatedly. But in the process of losing, and in the process of the protesters losing, they brought such media attention to the destruction of the trees that actually they were in the end successful and all of the trees were retained. And I'll go towards the later in the talk, I'll be talking about this idea of direct resistance for nature, which I very much will be urging all of you to step into in whatever ways you feel able or comfortable to do. But for me, that process of Sheffield, they wanted to chop down 17,500 mature street trees. And if any of you have ever been to Sheffield, the streets there in summer are like a cathedral of trees. Imagine like the pillars in a nave sort of stretching out into the distance down the street with these incredible, almost like a fan vaulting of branches going all the way over the street. And I had a realization there that if we have a system that allows those trees, healthy trees, to be destroyed just to save a few hundred quid for each bit of road repairs, that system must be broken. That system must be wrong, and we need to replace it with something. So I went out questing what could that answer be? And I very quickly found my answer in Rights of Nature, which is a growing movement around the world to say that nature should be inherently valued, that it should have rights, and it should have what's called legal personhood, which is representation within our legal system. Does anyone, again, know what legal personhood means? It's a bit of a lawyery term, a boring legal term, but very important. So you all here, as well as being actual persons, you're also legal persons by virtue of being human. So you have a right to, if someone commits a crime against you, you can call the police and press charges on them, but you can also bring a civil action. So if someone breaches a contract with you, or damages you in some way, you can bring legal action against them because you're a legal person. Now, it makes sense when you think of all humans having legal personhood, but how can a tree have legal person? How can a tree bring a legal case? Now, that makes a lot more sense when you realize that already in our system, there are non-humans that have legal personhood. Can anyone think who or what they might be? Companies, yeah. Also charities. So they're not inherently bad. But we do have a situation already where entirely fictional entities have legal personhood. And I do think it is a testament to the imagination, skill, and intelligence of English lawyers that we managed to give legal personhood to entirely fictional entities that we just made up in the mid-19th century before we gave it to trees, rivers, wildlife, and other natural entities, things that actually exist, that have existed in these lands before we as humans even came here, will exist long after we're gone, and which we fundamentally rely on for our own survival. And when you start realizing that our system doesn't even give a voice or a say to trees and rivers, you realize that it's somewhat broken. One of the things that I would really love to discuss in the Q&A, so I'm going to sort of trail it here, is that connection between religion, spirituality, dare I say morality, and law. Because we get so used to the existing laws in this country that we forget they actually all have effectively a moral or spiritual basis. And our role as lawyers is to effectively take moral, spiritual principles and write a code that can be applied in all different situations. So, for instance, we have the crime of murder, which has existed from time immemorial, but we don't ever think why do we have the crime of murder? Why is it wrong to kill another human being? And when you trace it back and you keep going down and down, you realize that's ultimately a moral, spiritual principle. A more obvious example of this is one that's changed much more recently. So that would be slavery. Up until 250 years ago in this country, slavery was considered to be completely normal, indeed an incredibly crucial and lucrative part of the British economy, slavery. And it was, I submit, a religious change that came first there, that people came to the moral principle that you shouldn't hold other human beings as slaves, and that you and that all humans should be born free effectively. And then lawyers translated that into law. And we now need to go through a similar process with nature, I believe, which should start, as well as a legal question, with a moral, spiritual question, where those people of faith in this country, particularly Christians, need to come together and help us overturn that original sin in Genesis. The idea which comes from religion, from the Christian tradition, that humans are somehow set apart from nature, that we are better than nature, that nature is a resource which we have dominion over, and that nature is not in some way sacred. And so I'd love, during the questions, if any of you could give suggestions about how we might start to do that, although I will also be giving some ideas at the end as well about ways that I think you could go about that. So I began researching rights of nature around the world, and although in England it seems, or in Britain, it seems like a very odd alien concept, the exciting thing, and in my mind the miraculous thing, is that this is already happening. There are places on Earth which already have rights of nature, where it is a legal reality that is happening here and now and is being used directly to save and protect nature pretty much as we speak. There are probably too many for me to go into in this talk, but some of the main ones are in Ecuador, which in 2008 put the rights of nature into its constitution. And that was a substantive right to effectively for nature to not be destroyed in a way that it can't regenerate itself. I could read out the actual constitutional provision, but it's slightly boring. But effectively, substantive rights of nature were put into its constitution. And since 2016, 2017, there have been many legal cases now numbering, I think, over 70 or 80, where in the courts have directly upheld the rights of nature to exist, to thrive, and to not be destroyed. And I just kind of almost want to pause there because, yeah, in Britain, it feels like a long way away, doesn't it? For trees and nature and rivers to have rights. But it's already happening. And last October, I actually went to Ecuador and I went to a forest called Los Cedros, which is just outside Quito. And it's a cloud forest, which is one of the richest ecosystems on Earth. A place so rich in life that just being there is a holy experience. In a way, you almost can't comprehend somewhere like Britain, where we have nature, but the sheer scale of nature there and its richness is almost hard to take in. And in 2022, the Ecuadorian Constitutional Court upheld the rights of the forest to exist and rejected mining licenses that would have destroyed the forest in order to mine underneath it. And I got to step alone into this cloud forest, which because of it's actually richer than the rainforest because it's higher up and wetter, and it has mist almost in the air all the time. So there's like layers of life. So you have the trees, then you have all the epiphytes growing on the trees, and then the things growing on the epiphytes. My friend John Moses refers to it as shit growing on shit growing on shit, which is maybe another way to think of it. But that's the richness of life there. You've got so much richness of life. There's things growing on things growing on things. And I got to sit there and by myself in this cloud forest and understand that this forest had been protected by rights of nature, and that therefore that was something that we needed to have in our lands too. I also went to the rainforest, so further east in Ecuador, and I went to visit a tribe called the Sinangue, who took the Ecuadorian government to court in 2017, again using rights of nature, to stop mining on their territory and to save their territory, which is, I think, 50,000 hectares of primary rainforest from gold mining licenses. And I went to the chief of the Sinangue. It's about 200 people in the village. There's not very many. And I went to ask him about this legal case. And basically in the first 30 seconds, he was like, yeah, the case was really interesting. But actually, can we tell you about how we take ayahuasca and how we use ayahuasca and the spirits of the forest to protect us from gold miners? And also about our Guardia Indígena, which was an indigenous guard force to actually uphold and enforce the law. Because although the government cancelled the mining licenses, illegal gold miners still came onto their territory to steal the gold effectively and destroy nature to take gold. And they set up their own volunteer guard force to patrol their territory and to protect it. And this is something I'm going to go on to in a minute when discussing about how we can transfer some of these lessons to these lands and indeed to our own lives. And I spoke to one of the people in the Guardia Indígena who was really, really enthusiastic. He was like their most enthusiastic member. And he said an amazing quote, which is, I asked him why he did what he did. And he said, it is an honor to protect nature. And that's something that I want as many people as possible to also feel, that honor. He also said something which we're going to circle back to in a minute, because towards the end of the trip, I asked him how about his time in the village, assuming he'd always been brought up there. We had this idea of indigenous people as being, you know, that's the place that they've been from for thousands of years. And he was like, actually, I'm not from here. I grew up in the coast in Ecuador, and I married a woman in this tribe and moved here 5 years ago. And I think that's really important, because sometimes we can over-pedestalize Indigenous people and say that, well, they only do that because they are effectively born there. It's in their lineage. That's what they do. And that is a lesson, I think, that that idea of guardianship of nature is open to all of us and something that we can all do. The other important rights of nature intervention, when it comes to taking lessons from around the world and applying them to the UK, is the river in New Zealand called the Whanganui River, which I don't know if many people here have heard of. You look very enthusiastic about it. Sorry? You've been there. That's more than me. It's one of my ambitions to go there. Did you know about the rights of nature when you were there? Amazing. I'd love to chat to you afterwards. That is a different rights of nature intervention, which effectively gives self-ownership and a guardianship body to a river in New Zealand. Now, the reason that that particularly interests me is that in the UK, we can sort of say, Ecuador and Colombia can have rights of nature because they've got their crazy, Spanish legal system and, indigenous groups in the rainforest. That's very different context to a common law European style context. But of course, New Zealand is one of the most similar legal systems in the world to Britain. We effectively exported our system there. We exported that Genesis quote and the Blackstone idea of property to them. And yet, in 2017, the New Zealand Parliament passed an act giving legal self-ownership and a guardianship body and legal personality to a river. Why did that happen? Anyone? I'm going to see if anyone... Go on, you're...
The Whanganui, or as it's known in English, Whanganui River, is seen as a god to the Maori people. It's their ancestor. And not just the river, but also the whole basin of it.
I think I heard a little bit of that. It's basically the Whanganui River is seen as sacred to the Maori people, as a god, as an ancestor, in fact. So, again, there was a slightly long story behind this, but to summarise it, the Maori people argued they'd never made peace with the British Crown because the Treaty of Waitangi was effectively mistranslated and they were given a fake version of it. And so in the new millennium, the New Zealand government wanted to make peace with the Maori people. And as part of those peace negotiations, the Maori demanded that their sacred river be given to them. And the British Crown said, nope, we're not giving you ownership of this river. It belongs to us. And they were at loggerheads. And then someone realized that both sides were talking about different things. When the British Crown was talking about ownership, they were talking this kind of Blackstonian dominion ownership that we have here, where, your name is written in a title register and you own that. You can destroy it. You can exclude people. You can do what you want with it. And the Maori weren't asking for that. Effectively, the closest corollary they had to their relationship was self-ownership, that the river was a sacred being and that it owned itself, but that they could act as its guardians, effectively. And so that's what was set up as a compromise, that the river would own itself. So the Crown's interest was transferred to the river itself. And they had a guardianship body consisting of a Maori representative and a Crown representative, and then lots of advisory bodies to advise about how the river should be governed. So, given that happened in New Zealand, which has, a very similar legal system to ours, we know that we could do that in the UK. And I think I've already... I usually say to people, what's the difference in Ecuador and New Zealand? But I've already trailed it quite heavily, which is, of course, the existence of Indigenous people. And what is it about Indigenous people that makes a difference? Turning it back to the religious context, the spiritual context, is they have a fundamentally different relationship to the earth than people in Judeo-Christian countries tend to. Their relationship is one of sacredness that regards effectively God as in all things, a much more pantheistic, animistic style religion. And they then bring that across into their laws. So that's why I was really excited to come and speak to you all today, because as a lawyer, I can suggest ways of bringing about rights of nature into our law, and I'm going to speak about some very briefly, but we are not going to have those legal changes unless we have a change in our spiritual connection with nature and with the land. And that comes from, hopefully, many of you, many of the people at this festival, and many religious, spiritual, and Christian groups in this country. I also want to, I guess, go into then how we can begin to create that connection between people and nature that better mirrors the indigenous ways of thinking. And I started thinking about the word indigenous and the very interesting fact that when we talk about it in places like Ecuador or New Zealand, we mean the Maori people or those or the Sinangwe. But when you say the word indigenous in England, it actually comes up as actually quite a concerning, almost quasi-racist term, doesn't it? And I was wondering, how then do we replicate that here? How can we replicate an indigenous connection to the land when we are in a country that lost its connection to nature so long ago that there is very little living tradition left of that sacred connection and bond between humans and nature? And I realized that we need to turn the word indigenous in these lands from a noun into a verb. It's not something you're born into. It's something you do. It's something you are. It's a relationship that you have. And my idea of indigeneity is that no matter where you're from, no matter what your passport says or where you were born, do you connect with these lands? Do you act to protect and restore them? Do you regard them as sacred? And do you enact that sacred relationship in your actions? If you do, then you are enacting that verb, that relationship of indigeneity. And to avoid, you know, difficulties with the term, I actually propose a new word that's not, that removes that the I word and it's all its political controversies. And to me, the closest approximation of that relationship, of that doing, is the word guardianship. And that humans in these lands need to rediscover a relationship of guardianship with nature, which is that we see nature as sacred, that nature is alive, that our sacred duty on earth is to protect and enrich nature. If and to help put you into the ways of thinking of that, you don't have to necessarily believe this is true, but just to run through your mind an exercise that if you were to imagine that heaven is here, that this is heaven, that this life is heaven, and that this is the Garden of Eden, how would that change your way of relating to the earth? How would that change your actions towards nature and what you regard as sacred? And that's the kind of relationship that I want people to step into. So I want to talk a little bit about guardianship and the practicalities of what that can mean, because as well as setting up lawyers for nature and dealing with the legal aspects of rights of nature, I also got really into practical guardianship of nature. And I want to really advertise it to you as being one of the best things I've ever done with my life. And that's something that a great source of wonder and joy to me. So in 2017, I've lived on a narrowboat for 12 years now. And for the first 5 years, I was sort of moving around London, just from mooring to mooring, being chased by a pen pusher in an office in Milton Keynes telling me I hadn't moved far enough. Got bored of that and began to search or maybe yearn for a deeper connection with nature. Not entirely realizing what I was stepping into at the time I did. But I literally got a map out of rivers in London and tried to work out where there were rivers without anyone looking after them, and found one in East London called the River Roding, which is London's third biggest river after the Thames and the Lea, but which had no one really looking after it. It had pretty much all the problems that a river could have. Its upper catchment's very rural, so it gets absolutely buggered by farmers. And then it flows down into outer London and then gets absolutely buggered in the urban area too. So that by the time it reaches the Thames, it's in a very, very sorry state. And in a slightly mad life decision, I just decided to move to this river by myself, declare myself effectively its guardian, and start looking after it. And it was the best thing I ever did, both for myself and also hopefully the river as well. There's almost too many things to go into in talking about that river and the guardianship, but I'll sort of detail a few. A crucial thing that I'd like to really say is that I didn't have permission from anyone to go and do that. I didn't own the land. I didn't have planning permission. I didn't have any permission from the council, the navigation authority, the environment agency. And also, crucially, if I had asked for permission from any of those agencies, they would have told me to bugger off. I do very much recommend, in seeking to become a nature guardian, seek forgiveness rather than permission. It generally works out better that way. It's slightly flippant, but genuinely true. There's a deep sort of almost badly conservative tendency in many agencies that look after nature in the UK, who don't do their jobs, but have a very kind of intense guarding of their landscape. So they won't let other people do it either. I've had quite a lot of funny discussions with the environment agency, some which I'll go into in a minute, in my looking after of the river. And other thing to do is to... So find a part of nature that needs a guardian. And to be honest, all of it does. I believe in a world in which every river, every woodland, every species, every area of nature has a guardian looking out for it. I believe that world is going to come, and that the key way in which it will come is if ordinary people prefigure it by just going and doing it. This is not going to be handed down from on high by people in Parliament. It is not going to be allowed by the Environment Agency or Canal and River Trust or any of these legacy bodies that supposedly are supposed to be looking after nature but don't do their jobs. It will happen by ordinary people just going and doing it. So I urge you all, if you take one thing out of this talk, it's to find a part of nature that desperately needs love, that desperately needs someone looking out for it and speaking for its interests, and go and do that. And I'm going to give you a three-stage way of doing it. It's very simple. Well, it's kind of complex, but the basic principles are simple. It starts with knowledge and connection. It then moves to love and then moves to protection. So to illustrate how this happened with me on the roading, I moved to the river, which makes it much easier because, you know, if you only experience a woodland by just walking in it occasionally, it's hard to get that deep knowledge of a place. So if you can choose somewhere that's close to you as possible, that you can get a deep knowledge of the place. And in many ways, being on a boat is the best way to do that, because it's like living in a giant bird hide. You're like in this little capsule, and for some reason, the wildlife can see you through the window, but you're not threatening to it. Maybe because you're low down in the boat. And you just see and experience the richness of nature around you all the time. And I live, as nothing to say as well, is that the place I live, it is not it's not the obvious natural place. So it's in Barking, Zone 4, one of the poorest boroughs in London. I live 100 metres from the North Circular. So you've got a North Circular here, one of the poorest estates in London there, a warehouse, pylons, the District Line, pollution, rubbish, social problems. It's got the lot. And yet I live in a semi-tidal marsh surrounded by Chetis warblers, kingfishers, all manner of wildlife there all the time. And that almost literal immersion in nature creates that deep knowledge which intrinsically, I believe, leads to love. in the same way that I think many of you will probably agree with me that humans have an innate desire to love God, I believe we have an innate desire to love nature. It's built in us, as if to love our children or to love God. It's to love nature is imbued. So if we just spend time in nature, a part of nature, and get to know it, we will grow to love that place. And then the final stage also arises naturally, that if you get to know a place and fall in love with it, you will have a deep desire to protect it. Because how can you not? How can you not want to protect that which you love when you see those who will harm it? And because that desire of protection stems from love, it comes with a depth, doesn't it? So that your actions in defense of it, people can feel your love and the power of that love when you're protecting it. And I've really started to lean into this, and I find it very powerful. So I joined the local catchment partnership for the River Roding. And everyone in that meeting, I'm usually the only person in the catchment partnership who is actually not paid to be there. But I'm also the only person that's radically speaking about the protection of the river, speaking up for its interests, and speaking with that love. And it started to shift the dial. Because if you go to Thames Water and just start spouting off acronyms at them, they can deal with acronyms. They've been dealing with acronyms for the last 30 years. They can bullshit you about the Water Framework Directive until the cows come home. But what they're not used to is a person who comes to them and says, I love this river. And you have to believe me that if you continue to harm this river, I will do whatever it peacefully takes, peacefully and lawfully, to harm your company in return. And I will do it. And I could see them sort of taken aback in those meetings. And they're not used to being addressed in those terms. And it has a deep, deep power to it. As another example, to move briefly away from rivers towards trees, and I had to bring this example in here because we are, I think it's the first time I've been back to Northamptonshire since this incident happened. And we got some people from Wellingborough in the audience here today. As a trailer, I think I'm the only person to ever be legally banned from climbing any tree in Northamptonshire. When I got that bail condition, I tweeted out that John Clare would be proud. And the Daily Mail put my tweet in, then had to explain to its readers who John Clare was, which I thought was beautiful. It's one of the only times John Clare has been featured in the Daily Mail, so that's another result. So again, it's another quite lengthy tree story, but I'll try and summarize it as best as possible. In February 2023, through my lawyers for nature, mailbox, I got an email from local tree protectors in Wellingborough saying that their trees were getting destroyed and they needed some help. I get a lot of those emails, and a lot of them I have to let go because I can't deal with them all. And I think I got back from a festival or a weekend away, and it was like 10 o'clock on a Sunday, and I opened the email and I thought, oh, I better just read it to make sure. And I read it and was like, oh, these trees have tree preservation orders on them, and actually it's therefore illegal to destroy these trees. So I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to have to take this one on. So I then literally knocked out an advice till 2 o'clock in the morning, and it got sent to the police on a Monday. And then the police ignored it and still facilitated a developer to chop down, I think, around 60 trees in one of the longest avenues of lime trees in the country in Wellingborough, the pride of the town. And on Monday afternoon, my case the next day settled. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go to Wellingborough and see what happens. So I turned up to Wellingborough. And next morning, bright and early, went to the police at 8 a.m. and took the officer through my barrister's advice, where I set out how it was illegal to fell these trees. And the officer ignored me and said, we're not here to take sides. And then 15 minutes later, I saw him walking towards us in front of a phalanx of police officers, clearly about to take sides and knowing it wasn't on our side. And he then threatened to arrest anyone who stood under the trees for aggravated trespass. And there's an amazing video where I'm yelling at him about the provisions of the tree tree protection regulations 2013 and why he was ignoring them. And in that moment, I had a choice of, I knew I was on the right in the law and I could have challenged it a year down the line through various appeal courts, but then the trees would be gone. And so I decided to do something which, in the right circumstances, I'm recommending to you all, which is what I've come to understand as satyagraha for nature. Peaceful resistance for nature. Always peaceful, but putting your body in the on the line for nature and physically preventing those who would destroy nature. In that instance, I was doing it knowing the law was on my side, which was quite helpful. But also people have done it in all different circumstances, from Sheffield to all around the country, to protect nature. And so I climbed the tree. And we're running out of time, aren't we? I know. Okay, I'll try and do 5 more minutes and then we'll do questions. It always happens. I always think I'm never going to have enough to say and then I keep waffling on. So I climbed the tree to stop it being felled. And the police put me under arrest whilst I was in the tree. And then also then put Harris fencing around me and crime scene tape around the entire tree. But also hilariously, luckily, I had my phone in my pocket. And this is another thing you need to do as well. It's not just about doing the physical action. It's how you play it. And social media is amazing for that. In my pocket, I was able to communicate to the entire world without any media, without any having to get in any newspaper. I just tweeted out. So I did a beautiful thread where I literally screenshotted the legal advice so anyone could see for themselves my legal reasoning, and then had a video of me in the tree, and it went viral around the world. The local council social media effectively went into meltdown. The local police, bless Northamptonshire police, really quite bumbling and didn't really know what they were doing. And by the end of the day, the local council leader came down to the site and managed to negotiate me coming down from the tree if we had a meeting about the trees. And they were saved for that day. Crucially as well, the next day someone else climbed the tree in inspiration, which was great. But more importantly, there was a local campaign of ordinary people in Wellingborough acting as guardians for those trees. Without that, my act would have meant nothing. They would just come back a few days later to chop the trees down. And it is the local people who then took the council to court, raised £60,000 to bring a judicial review, and won against the council. They were right all along. And both those acts were important. My act alone wouldn't have done anything because they would have come back later. But equally, if just a legal case by itself is pointless if the tree is gone. So these two things are often to be held together. And that's just another example of guardianship. And on the roading, there are many, many others. From, again, direct action for nature. So planting trees, again, without any permission whatsoever. And I had a really great meeting with the Environment Agency recently where their flood defense team requested a meeting with me because they were getting annoyed that I kept planting willows in front of their flood defences. And we had a meeting and I said, well, I'm doing this in the river's interests, and the hard flood defences that you're putting in for the river are terrible for the river. So if you can give me any other proposal that you have for softening these river defences, I'm really happy to go with that. It's kind of annoying having to plant these trees. And they were like, our plan is just to leave the hard river defences and not do anything. And I was like, well, in that case, I'm going to keep planting my trees. And they were like, you're not allowed to do that. And I'm like, I'm going to do it anyway. And they were like, it is illegal. You don't have a flood risk permit. And I was like, that's interesting. I'm going to keep doing it. And I think it would be hilarious if you were to prosecute me for planting trees when you can't prosecute Thames Water for illegally spilling sewage into the river. So it would actually be quite funny for you to do that. And she was like, oh. And she was like, well, we'll come and remove the trees. And I'm like, well, you can. But I think that my ability to keep planting these trees outstrips your ability to remove them. Especially because they're free, because you just coppice the willow and stick it in the ground. Which, did anyone know that? You can do that, by the way. Right? If you want to demonstrate to anyone the miracle of resurrection, just take them to a willow tree. You chop a branch off, you stick it in the ground, it grows into a whole new tree. It's like the miracle of life. You can just create trees from trees indefinitely. What a miracle that is. What a wonderful thing to be able to do. So that's one thing there. Planting trees without permission, taking rubbish out without permission, fighting Thames water in whatever way I can. There is, of course, the March for Clean Water happening on the 26th of October. I recommend anyone to come down for that and to make the voice heard on behalf of your river. But crucially, I'm realizing that all these practical actions have at their heart a deeper spiritual one. Because when I moved to the river 7 years ago, I did not intend to fall in love with it. I did not intend to regard that river as sacred. Indeed, I think I was an atheist back then. And actually, my connection to the river, my increasing realization that my river is sacred and it's holy, has actually been for me the wellspring of my own faith that's drawing me towards faith, to what I would now regard as adjacent to Christianity. We can go into that more later if you want to in questions. And a few weeks ago, just to finish off, I was able to really bring all these threads together. I was called to jury service in Snaresbrook Crown Court. And I didn't get called up the first day. And on the second day, I was going to court and I was like, actually, what? Because, you know, you can either swear on a Bible or you can affirm. And I was like, I don't actually know what I want to do because I don't actually, you know, the Bible is maybe a bit too far for me, but actually an affirmation is a bit lame and I'm not an atheist anymore. Like, I believe in the spirit. I believe in the sacredness of the earth. And I was like, what can I do? And I was on my way to the station. I was like, shit, the river. Of course, the river. So I was late for jury service. I was like, I've got to do this. So I literally found a plastic bottle on the floor next to me on the street, cycled back to my river and took a bottle of water from the river and got to court. And the usher outside court said, so who wants to swear on the Bible or who wants to affirm? And I said, I'd like to swear on my river, actually. He looked perplexed and went into the judge. And then the judge called me in, also looked perplexed, but with a wry smile. Like, he wasn't annoyed. He was intrigued in the kind of the way that someone's probably actually day to day is a little bit boring, actually, you know, at least it livens it up. So he's like, Mr. Powson, I believe you want to swear on a river. I confess we haven't had that request before. And I said, well, yeah, actually, I find my river to be sacred. I find my river to be holy. And I've demonstrated my love and care towards that in numerous acts. And I started telling a little bit about the rubbish and the trees and all of these things, which I guess is a version of Christian charity towards nature, right? A demonstration, a living demonstration of my faith through action. And in the end, we came to a slight compromise where the legal niceties were ticked off by me doing the affirmation, but he also allowed me to swear on the river. So I poured it into a glass, plastic cup, put my finger in it, and said, I swear by the river Roding from her source in Molehill Green to her confluence with the Thames that I will faithfully try the defendant and give a true verdict according to the evidence. And that was the first time anyone's ever sworn on a river or I believe any part of nature in a UK court. And it was powerful, actually. It wasn't just a gimmick. It was meaningful for me, but more crucially sets up the idea to go right back to the start of the talk. It goes right back to that heart of the biblical underpinnings of our current destructiveness towards nature and rips up that page of Genesis and says that actually nature is not dead. It is not just a resource to be used by us because we are in dominion over it. Nature is sacred. Nature is holy. The earth is our church. And we must step into a relationship of guardianship, of peaceful and loving protection and action and enrichment of life. And I really urge you all, if you are able to take that away today. How can you broaden your faith to include those ideas of nature? Thank you. I do this every time. At the start of the talk, I'm like, oh, I'm going to have too much time and not enough to say, and then I always go over into questions every time. So we've only got about 10 minutes, but what I'll do is I'll take as many questions as possible now, and then I'll do my other tactic of they'll clear us out because they want to take the stage back, but I'm happy to come and like just sit outside under the trees over there and continue chatting with anyone. I genuinely love to talk about these ideas with people. Almost every talk I've ever done, I've learned new things, and even challenging questions have made me think anew and come up. So if there's something that's challenging you want to put across, please do, because what will happen is in 2 weeks' time I'll be like, oh, that person at the end of that talk at Greenbelt, they made that point and I couldn't answer it, and in the shower I'll come up with the answer to the question then introduce my next talk. So you know, just all while cycling along one day. So please do throw whatever at me, and also any discussions, ideas, I'd love your ideas about how we bring faith and nature and these questions together. So, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Fascinating talk. Really, really enjoyed it. Thank you. You asked about the connection with theology, spirituality, nature. I mean, we could talk at length about the fundamental misunderstanding of the word dominion. It was just a wrong understanding of the Hebrew, what the Hebrew Bible was trying to get across, which was about caring and about stewardship. But another thing, the verse that's most loved by evangelical Christians is John 3:16. For God so loved the world, he gave his only son. Whoever believes in him should not perish. Well, the word for world that's used is cosmos, which is an all-embracing world. God loved everything about the world, everything in it. So if God loves it all, should we not love it too? So just a suggestion.
Yeah. No, I think that beautiful. And you know, I, as a non-Christian, I don't know how far to push the idea that verse was misinterpreted. I think it was, and I'd like to believe that it was. I'm not an expert in theology, so I don't know how far to push that. If anyone has any recommendations to articles or deeper theological expositions of that verse, because I do believe it is an important misstep that humanity's made, possibly one of our worst, and that lawyers have then taken and run with it in a way that is incredibly damaging and destructive, and we do need to change it. So any detailed exhibitions, please do throw them at me afterwards.
In Macclesfield, we have a carbon peat bog moss area that is going to be built on, or they're hoping to build on it. So I can imagine a situation where some of us want to go and sit there and stop it. But increasingly, these things have become civil matters and injunctions. And injunctions are quite scary. And I'm not quite sure how to handle that fear of the consequences of an injunction.
Yeah. Actually, it's one of the things I do is injunction work. I don't actually do criminal law, as I never qualify as one, but I was a civil lawyer. So I've ended up doing quite a lot of injunction work for environmental protesters. They are quite scary. They are also not impervious to resistance. Because they are quite political, they are also much more susceptible to political resistance. I was actually named in one myself. There was a tree called the Happy Man Tree they wanted to chop down, and I went to visit protesters there and climb the tree. Not when they're trying to chop it down, just climb the tree to experience it. And they made put a case which is now one of the main cases that is cited for me online is one where I'm a defendant. So the London Borough of Hackney v. Powsland and others is that injunction case. But it's interesting, since that injunction, Hackney, I don't think, has ever got one again. And similarly in Sheffield, they got injunctions against protests. And it was the getting of those injunctions that actually, in many ways, forced the issue and brought victory to the protesters. I'll give you a very quick example of how that happened. The council got an injunction, and a lot of people were like, well, I guess we have to give up now because we're going to lose our homes and we're going to go to jail. And one protester called Calvin posted on Facebook saying, you know what? This injunction is rubbish. I'm going to break it. And I urge as many of you as possible to break it as well. And I saw that. And do you know the phrase courage calls to courage everywhere? That boy did that. And I messaged him saying, if you ever get in trouble for that statement, I'll represent you for free. And he did. And unfortunately, one of the parts of the injunction was that you can't encourage others to break it. So it was a difficult legal argument for me to make. And he got convicted for it and he got a suspended jail sentence. But did that, that brought all the journalists to town and brought all the publicity to the campaign. And it was a crucial turning point. And it was interesting that, you know, this idea of using the strength of your opponent against them, like the council hit, but they hit too hard. And actually trying to put one of the people that then broke the injunction after Calvin was a 65-year-old retired primary school teacher who was partially deaf. And they tried to put her in jail for standing under a tree. It's like, you have no understanding of PR or how these things work. Like, you look awful. You look, and not only did they lose that case, Sheffield Labour, you know, one of the most staunchest Labour councils in the country, lost power partially because of doing that. So yes, they are scary and do seek legal advice. I do represent environmental protests and injunction cases wherever I can, but also understand that injunctions are political and that actually the only sanction they have is to jail people, and that jailing people for peaceful protection of nature is not a good look. And the judiciary is really reluctant to do it because they know it makes them look awful.
Thank you so much for working from your own skill set and your education and your own experience in order to protect nature. We're here in, I think probably like one in three people here is some kind of clergy person or a lay minister of some kind involved in their parishes and their benefices. And I'm wondering what the Church of England and the other churches in on these islands can do to support environmental activists and support people who are climbing up trees and protecting rivers. You know, even if it's like, what kind of sanctuary can churches become to protect those who are protecting nature?
That's a whole talk in its own right, isn't it? God, I wish we had more time. Yeah, loads. Crucial thing, you said my own skills. I have never trained in ecology. I am not a trained ecologist, right? So on the river, the only things I know is from what I've self-taught. But here's the miraculous thing. Nature is your teacher. I know in my heart that anybody can learn what nature wants and what enriches nature by just spending time in it and looking at it. Look at the places that are richest in nature and copy what they have. So go and spend time in churches that have churchyards full of nature. What will you find? Native trees. You'll find grasses that aren't cut too much. You'll find wildflowers. Copy them. You just see it and you copy it. So obviously rewilding of churchyards. Stop the desecration of churchyard yews. Almost every yew I've come across in churchyards, which frankly most yews are actually more precious in the church next to them. They're older and actually less, they're rarer. And yet churches across the country massacre them by chopping off the lower branches because they make the graveyards untidy. But those lower branches are being put out by the yew, often over the course of hundreds of years, to stabilize it. So if you chop the lower branches off, a storm will come and knock the tree over. Leave the yews alone and regard them as actually more precious than even your churches a lot of the time. But actually it goes deeper than just the land on which the churches are churchyards. And there's a campaign by Wildcard at the moment for the Church of England to rewild its land. The Church of England has 105,000 acres of land that it owns, and it has, I think, less than a third of the normal tree cover around England, which is already pretty low. They have less than a third of that on church land, which is appalling. And they're asking a simple question: if Jesus had 105,000 acres of land, what would he do with it? Enrich life. Let life be rich as possible. And I'm just going to, one more question. I'll read a very quick poem, if that's all right. Yeah.
I'm now hiding behind the thing. Hello. So I got like very interested in like permaculture principles and was looking through something a couple of weeks ago and found that the water catchment area that I live in the south of Birmingham is connected to not the seven, which is the people who I have to pay for water, although arguably potentially not, if anyone was at the last talk, why are we paying them to put shit in the river? But actually to the River Humber, which is where I grew up. And just that, making that connection was something that was like really profoundly powerful to me, that I was like, I thought I'd moved away from that place where I grew up, where I fell in love with nature, where I could see the seals going down the estuary. And so there's so much in Christian spirituality about water. And I went to a baptism a couple of years ago, where they actually, it was a village church in the Cotswolds, and they still go down to the river to baptize their kids, their family members. And it was such a powerful experience. And as much as we don't have that necessarily indigeneity, that culture anymore, but there's still kind of older versions of Christianity that were connected to the people in the land in a more of a way than we are now. And so I think, you know, when we read the story of Jesus's baptism in the River Jordan, in the land where he was from, where his people were from, there's so much of that I think we can still like revitalize in our practices.
Definitely. And it's really crucial to do that as well, because as I said before, we will not save our rivers just by acronyms. Laws have clearly failed. Unless we regard our rivers as sacred once again, they will continue to be destroyed. Every single drop of rain that falls to the earth in this country falls into a river catchment. Do you all know what river catchment you live in? Can you begin to regard it as sacred again? And crucially, can you begin to demonstrate that love to others, so that they may feel it too? They'll feel the force of your faith. Because on the roading, that start to happen. People have seen, at first they thought I was weird. They probably still do that a little bit, but they're like, who's that weird guy expressing that his river is sacred? But they've begun to feel it too. And that starts changing the way that everyone relates to their river. And on the March for Clean Water on the 26th of October, it's not just an environmental NGO acronym march. It is going to be it's going to have spiritual elements to it. So we want to have a ceremony which encompasses maybe water from every river in the country. Can you come and help create that ceremony? An interfaith ceremony of water to demonstrate to others that we hold it sacred. One last thing before I read a poem quickly, just to back on this point of what can we do? One of the most poisonous ideas I've heard is the idea of humans as being a cancer on the earth, and that the earth would be better off without us. That's not true for a whole host of reasons. We know that one of the reasons we're here is to revel in and delight in the beauty of the earth, because that is in itself part of what nature wants, I believe. But crucially, we are here to enrich life. Humans have a role as an apex species to enrich life, and we should see ourselves more as beavers, which is an apex species that by living its life and doing what it does actually makes life richer around it. We know that woodlands that are coppiced are richer. We know that meadows that are strimmed correctly are actually richer than ones that are let go. So in everything, how can we enrich life? And I say, spend time in nature, and that question I think will answer itself to you. Before we end, I just realized that I hadn't read this poem that I wanted to. One of the people you should read if you're interested in these kind of questions is Thomas Berry, an amazing theologian who started to really grapple with this idea, how do we bridge religion, Christianity, and the need to restore the earth. And he wrote a poem called Morningside Cathedral, which I'm just going to read to you here. We have heard in this cathedral Bach's Passion, the Lamentations of Jeremiah, ancient experiences of darkness over the earth, light born anew. But now, darkness deeper than even God can reach with a quick healing power. What sound, what song, what cry appropriate? What cry can bring a healing when a million-year rainfall can hardly wash away the life-destroying stain? What sound? Listen, earth sound. Listen, the wind through the hemlock. Listen, the owl's soft hooting in the winter night. Listen, the wolf song. Cry of distant meanings woven into seamless sound. Never before has the cry of the wolf expressed such meaning on the winter mountainside. Morningside, this cry our revelation. As the sun sinks lower in the sky over our wounded world, the meaning of the moment and the healing of the wound are there in a single cry, a throat open wide for the wild sacred sound of some great spirit. If we could only open to the wolf as guardian spirit, as saviour guide, our Jeremiah telling us not about the destruction of Jerusalem or its temple, our Augustine telling us not about the destruction of Rome and civilization, our Bach telling us not about the passion of Christ in ancient times, but about the passion of earth in our times. Wolf, our earth, our Christ, ourselves. The arch of the cathedral itself takes on the shape of the uplifted throat of the wolf, lamenting our present destiny, beseeching mankind to bring back the sun, to let the flowers bloom in the meadows, the rivers run through the hills, and let the earth and all its living creatures live their wild, fierce, serene, and abundant life. Thank you. And then I'll be probably under these trees over there if anyone wants to continue the conversation, have a chat, or ask any other questions. Thank you so much for being a wonderful audience. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.